This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today, folks, we are going on a journey into the deep past. It's a journey we go on a lot on Dreamland, and those of you who are Dreamlanders from a while back know that the search for what came before what we think of as civilization is a big part of this show. And one of the great researchers and adventurers is Dr. Robert Schock. Dr. Schock goes out in the field, and that's important on this show. We really do prefer people who don't just do research, but actually are there. He has done some of the, what I regard as some of the absolutely critical research into the past that has been done in modern times. He is the person who redated the Sphinx and realized and understood that the Sphinx is really much older than has been assumed by Egyptologists. And when he began to publish about this, they, of course, there was a big explosion, and everyone said, well, there was nothing going on then. How, who built it in the distant past? Okay, we're going to start there. Welcoming Robert Schock. He is a tenured faculty member at Boston U, earned his doctorate in geology and geophysics at Yale, and so we can expect an authoritative voice here. And I'm very happy to add that his wife, Katie, who works with him, they work together, they go on all of these adventures together, is with us too. So I would like to welcome you both to Dreamland.
Well, thank you very much. We're glad to be here.
Indeed, thank you.
Well, good. Now, I want to go back to the what happened. And why did you date the Sphinx when you did?
Well, there's actually a number of reasons, but to put it very simply, there were two big lines of evidence, two major lines of evidence, if I could put it that way, that are very important to me with dating the Sphinx. One is very simple and straightforward for most people to understand, and that is the weathering and erosion patterns on the Sphinx. The current Sphinx sits on the edge of the Sahara Desert. The Sahara Desert, we know geologically, has been there for about 5,000 plus years. But what I found, and you can see this very clearly when you go to the Sphinx, and I show people the Sphinx in person, or from even photographs, the Sphinx and the enclosure walls where the Sphinx was carved down into the bedrock show evidence of water precipitation, rain weathering, water runoff, which has to have occurred prior to the hyper-arid desert conditions. So essentially, it puts the Sphinx back to an earlier climatic period, the origins of the Sphinx. I always like to point out very clearly that the head has been recarved. The head is not the original head. It's a dynastic recarving. It's too small for the body. It's the core body, the oldest portions of the Sphinx that go back to this much more remote period. Now, how far back does it go? I now put the origins of the Sphinx back to the end of the last ice age, in rough terms, about 10,000 BC, which is absolutely amazing for most people to ponder, because that's about 6,000 plus years before the classical view of when civilization even began. So you can imagine many of my academic colleagues have gotten upset over my redating of the Sphinx during the course of the last few decades. I want to mention one other piece of evidence. It's more complicated, but we did seismic studies under the Sphinx to look at the depth and penetration of subsurface mineralogical changes. And with that, I was able to independently date the core body of the Sphinx back to the same remote period.
And that period, what is exactly is it called geologically?
It is the end of the last ice age, and geologically we refer to it as the Younger Dryas. It's the terminal period of the Pleistocene, the period of the Ice Ages. The period of the Ice Ages is referred to generally as the Pleistocene, and there were a number of different Ice Ages. The last Ice Age lasted about 100,000 years or so, and the last 1,200 years of that period is known as the Younger Dryas. And there's been a lot of talk about the Younger Dryas in the, I'll call it the popular literature recently, and what caused the Younger Dryas, and also what caused us to snap out of the last Ice Age. Just to put in slight perspective, or a little bit of perspective, the Younger Dryas begins... The Younger Dryas begins about 10,900 BC. It's a cold snap because the Ice Age was actually warming up. We were coming out of the Ice Age. Then there's a temporary cold snap at 10,900 BC. It gets colder than it was for the previous few thousands of years. So the Ice Age, in a sense, comes back for 1,200 years, because then in 9700 BC, all of a sudden, based on ice core data from Greenland, within just a couple of weeks, in fact, probably literally overnight, we snap out of the Ice Age. Temperatures rise precipitously. They just go straight up, essentially.
So it was just a matter
overnight.
It could have been a matter of days or weeks.
Oh, it was definitely no more than weeks. And based on the evidence, we cannot rule out the possibility that literally happened overnight. It literally happened within a day or two.
Now, here's what we're looking at, if I'm right. One complete intact climate system one day, and the next day another one.
Correct. I think that is a fair assessment of it when you're coming out of the Ice Age at 9700 BC. I don't think that's necessarily a fair assessment at the beginning of the Younger Dryas at 10,900 BC, and I could elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, yeah, and that'll be great because I'm eager to hear it, and I'm sure my listeners are too. And Free Dreamlanders, I know you're not as eager to hear these ads, but get rid of them. It's very simple. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com. We'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff. Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like, and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's getting great reviews. Take a look on Amazon. It's available as a Kindle, as an ebook everywhere else, and as a paperback at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and as also as a hardcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and as an audiobook read by me on Audible.com. This is Whitley Strieber. We're back on Dreamland. We're talking to Dr. Robert Schock and Katie Schock about the deep past. You have what it, to me is going to be an incredible documentary about this. And before we return to our discussion, would you tell us a little bit about the documentary? And folks, if you go to the Dreamland page of this show, you will be able to click on that documentary. I think it'll be on robertschock.com or wherever it is, you'll be able to get to it from the Dreamland page. It blew my mind. It's a preview of about 3 minutes. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. We're very excited about it. It's a documentary. We're calling it right now Civilization Before Civilization, because the documentary is really talking about this early cycle, as I call it, of civilization that goes back to the end of the last ice age. Last month, Katie and I were just in Turkey filming for the documentary. We're working on this with a not-for-profit Organization for the Research of Ancient Cultures, which is also goes by the acronym ORCUL. But we're working on this documentary, and you are correct. People should go to my website, Robert Schock, robertschoch.com, and they will find a link then to the documentary trailer. It's a preliminary trailer based on our work in Turkey. But we're really going to cover this, we believe, very important story of this earlier cycle of civilization, what brought it to a demise at the end of the last ice age. This ties in with natural catastrophic events that, you know, humanity can't control.
Right.
And there's also a story for the present day, because these events, I believe, based on the evidence, were caused by the sun, by a solar outburst.
And we're gonna talk about that in a few minutes, because one of the main themes of this show that we're doing together right now is going to be the relationship between what happened then and what might happen now.
Exactly.
Now,
incredibly important.
But what I want to do is to go back to the then, to that incredible day or night when everything changed. What was that like, and why did it happen?
Well, it was a situation where you were at the end of the last ice age. The ice was not covering the entire planet. Sometimes non-geologists think the ice age, ice is everywhere, glaciers are everywhere. No, that wasn't the case. They were at high latitudes, northern latitudes in particular. But in 9700 BC, and we know that date very precisely based on Greenland ice cores, all the evidence indicates that our sun, which is not as stable a star as many people seem to believe or want to believe, it underwent a major solar outburst, coronal mass ejections, solar flares, what are now sometimes referred to as a micronova. That's a new term that's now being used for what a star can do. And this would have literally, quote, fried, unquote, parts of the surface of the Earth. It would have melted glaciers, or did melt glaciers, almost instantaneously. It caused sea level rises. You put all this moisture into the atmosphere. It comes down as precipitation, as torrential rains. We actually see that on the body of the Sphinx. So I've tied that back to my work on the Sphinx. It was a calamitous time, and it would cause earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. We now know those correlate with solar activity. That's has been controversial in the past, but now it's understood that, in fact, a lot of Earth processes correlate with solar activity, and not simply because you change the distribution of weight when you melt all these glaciers, so that causes more volcanic and earthquake activity, but even the strong magnetic fields of the sun impacting the Earth and the geomagnetic field can set off earthquakes that were about to happen, can set off other types of catastrophes. So it was a very calamitous time. We have myths that have long been understood to refer to a catastrophe, but my academic colleagues would always just dismiss mythology as nonsense, you know, not real. But now we realize that, yes, these things were really happening, and we have to put all this evidence together. And 9700 BC, we are convinced, Katie and I are convinced, is a really critical date in for humanity. And it essentially destroyed this early cycle of civilization and brought them to their knees, so to speak, devastated the civilization or civilizations of that time, and it took another 6,000 years for civilization to reemerge. We've actually referred, Katie and I, this began in a conversation, we came up with, or Katie actually came up with the term solar-induced dark age, that the sun had induced this dark age for humanity, which lasted from about 9700 BC to the reemergence of civilization, for instance, dynastic Egypt, in about 3700-3500 BC, and, you know, becomes full-fledged civilization by 3000 BC again. It's a very different story. It's an up and down. It's not just the straight line progression of getting better and better.
You know, Barbara Hand Clow wrote a classic book, which I'm sure you're both familiar with, called, in any case,
I know the book you mean.
Right.
I can't think of the title offhand either.
I can't either, but I will in a minute. But it advances the idea that we live in a state of amnesia about our past because of the trauma that was involved. She calls it, I think, catastrophic amnesia or something like that. But I always think that when it seems the evidence is now almost overwhelming, and in fact, it is overwhelming. It's been overwhelming to a careful observer outside of the scientific community for a long time. But one of the things that's hardest to do is to face the fact that there is something deeply unstable in this about this solar system, and we are actually vulnerable to it, and we have a situation where it could happen again, but we don't know enough about it. I know that one of the reasons this NASA has sent that probe to the sun is to try to understand it. And one of the things that concerns me is this, and I'm sure you can talk to this, as to the Carrington event, what happened after the Carrington event, and the condition of the sun now. Can you tell us about the Carrington event and the state of the sun immediately before the Carrington event?
Oh, yes. This is very interesting because the Carrington event in 1859 is an important date because if you think about 1859, where were we as a civilization? We were still pre-electricity for the most part. There were telegraph lines. Electricity was just starting to be used, but we did not have grid systems. We did not have the dependence on electricity that we have now. And the Carrington event was a couple of coronal mass ejections shot out by the sun. They're called coronal mass ejections, basically big balls of plasma or charged particles moving at relativistic speeds. That means a good percentage of the speed of light coming in, and they hit the Earth, and they disturb the geomagnetic fields. They suppress the different layers of the atmosphere down. It drove it down, and it overloaded the telegraph system lines at the time. The telegraph lines basically acted as huge antennae, picking up the magnetic fields that were crossing the Earth. It caused aurora borealis-type phenomena around the Earth, so people saw these things in the sky, which is important to our story because we now have lots of records in ancient times of people seeing similar things in the sky when you have a major solar outburst. The Carrington event, I want to stress, was very, very small from an astrophysical perspective. It was tiny, yet it caused incredible destruction to the primitive electronics at the time. It literally burnt down telegraph buildings. They caught on fire. It overloaded the system. If we had a Carrington event today, it would devastate modern technological society based on electronics and electrical grid systems.
Well, when you say it's tiny, you're saying it's tiny in comparison to what the sun is capable of producing.
Correct.
But, I mean, it was an X-15 ejection of some
something
sort, they
or
estimate.
Higher.
So it was a very intense CME. Actually, two of them, I believe, right?
Yeah, there were two.
So
it was very intense from a historical point of view, but you have to remember we're talking only the last few centuries for comparison. And what we're finding now, and when I say what we're finding now, this is data that's coming from a number of different scientists around the world in the last 5 years or so, that recently, we're now finding evidence that there were other events even stronger than the Carrington event, even in the recent past. For instance, there was something known as the Charlemagne event,
which was
even stronger. Why the Charlemagne event? Because it occurred around, I want to say, 775 AD, when Charlemagne was emperor. So it's been referred to as the Charlemagne event. If a Charlemagne event hit now, we wouldn't be talking. Yeah, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
All the
electronics would be down. Yeah. Billions of people would die. I hate to sound this way.
We're vulnerable.
We're very, very vulnerable. Our civilization is so incredibly vulnerable to solar events. And all of the ones that I've mentioned, Charlemagne event, Carrington event, a number of other smaller events and larger events that have been now documented in the last, say, 10,000 or so years in the geologic record, in the isotope record that we have from Greenland ice cores, that type of thing, are all incredibly small compared to what happened in 9700 BC at the end of the last ice age. And not to be scary, but there is plenty of evidence that what was happening to the sun at the end of the last ice age, the sun is going back into that same type of unstable period.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons we're talking today.
Exactly.
And free Dreamlanders, we're going to keep talking for you in just a minute. As always, I like to remind our listeners that the beautiful opening music, our theme music, was chosen by Ramona Bell way back at the beginning of Dreamland. It is Ray Lynch's lovely tune, The O of Pleasure. We'll be right back.
They are found deep in a dying jungle, 6 infants. They aren't apes. They aren't human either, not quite. So what are they? When they are spirited off to the United States, an incredible discovery is made. They are as smart as us, but not us, not human. The company that found them wants to buy and sell them as the most valuable animals on Earth, brilliant workers who need not be paid. Somebody has to stop this travesty, and that's where primatologist Beth Cook comes in. But can she stand up to the power and wealth that seeks to exploit them? Find out in Whitley Strieber's first standalone science fiction novel in 7 years. New. Get it on Amazon as an ebook or paperback.
As a subscriber of Dreamland for many years, it's been an incredible adventure and truly a Rosetta Stone for so many of the experiences that all of your listeners have had. Please join us. It's a fantastic ride. But I will say that certainly Dreamland does reflect something that I've always known, that man's mind mirrors a universe that mirrors man's mind. And no other place will you get this truth than on Dreamland. Come join us.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's Meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more.
The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. As little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
We're talking to Robert and Katie Schock. Their website is robertschock.com. You can link to it from the Dreamland page. They're doing an incredible documentary. I say it's incredible because I know them, and I know from seeing what I've seen of it that it's going to be a real breakthrough. You can look at the preview, and you can donate to the completion of this documentary on oracle.com. All of the links will be on our page, so it's easy to do. Now, getting back to this connection between the sun now and the sun in the distant past, let's return to the period of the younger, I guess just beginning of the younger Dryas. Am I right?
Well, there's the younger Dryas. The younger Dryas lasts about 1,200 years.
But I'm trying to go back to the point where that night or that day when everything changed.
Okay.
The ending.
Okay,
the ending,
if I could clarify just a little bit. The younger Dryas begins 10,900 B.C. and it ends at 9,700 B.C. The huge change is at 9,700 B.C., just under 12,000 years ago, and that is the end of the last ice age. That's when literally everything changed overnight.
And that's when that's when all these flood stories and so forth start. Right. Yeah. So, and also, isn't that when the Clovis people more or less disappeared from?
Yeah, yes, more or less. In fact, not only the Clovis people, but this has been very well documented now. Numerous large mammals went extinct at that time. And I say numerous large mammals. We humans actually are large mammals. And when you had these solar outbursts, not only did it cause the flooding, not only did glaciers melt, not only did climate change, not only did you have earthquakes and volcanic activity in abundance, but you had high radiation levels on the surface of the Earth.
And cosmic ray penetration, wouldn't that?
Yeah, cosmic ray penetration, and the best way to escape that is to go underground, to go into rock shelters, to go into caves.
And folks, just let me stop you for a minute. In the preview of the documentary, Robert goes into one of these places, and what he says in there is going to absolutely blow your mind about this place. Where was it, Robert, or where is it? Because you can still go in there. And who built it?
It's not just one place. No, Robert, you know the question was directed to you, but I just wanted to point out.
No, please, please, Katie, I love you being in this.
He's in one of the many underground cities in the Anatolia region of Turkey, and now it's in the Cappadocia region of Turkey. And the one that we actually filmed in two of them, we filmed in Derinkuyu and Kaimakli. I think the one in the clip is Derinkuyu. And they housed tens of thousands of people each. So you are talking about solid rock, multi-level shelter for an enormous number of people, such that we think this explains why civilization reemerges. It's one of the pockets that survived the period that we call Siddha, a solar-induced dark age. They did so by going underground for the difficult periods, and a large enough population could sustain itself there. But my husband's a scientist.
I think
with the drama of the theater person. So.
I think Katie just said it well. The way you survive, the best way to survive is to go under rock, to go into caves. I believe, as I intimated in the little trailer, and we'll talk about this more in the documentary, I talk more about this in my books and that type of thing. First, they had to escape. So they escaped. They went into natural caves. Then they started carving underground to have these places of refuge. And that's how they survived. Because something that you have to understand, too, is they may have had some forewarning of it before the major solar outburst at 9700 BC. There may have been some smaller ones that got them thinking about this.
Yeah, that was my next question, actually.
They may actually have fully known what we don't, or we're beginning to speculate, and that is that our sun does have recurring cycles, that something destabilizes our sun and perpetually, as Plato says, sends us back to a very childlike beginning again. We
keep right.
knock down and reset, and we have to climb back up again. It seems to me that the last cycle of civilization, as evidence, we haven't gotten into it yet, but it is in the little clip, the trailer.
Right.
Incredibly sophisticated site in Turkey, very near to Cappadocia, the site of Göbekli Tepe, with the giant T-pillars and the astronomical alignments and all of that. That's sophisticated culture, and
very, yes.
not primitive people. I mean, you're looking at carving the Sphinx and carving Göbekli Tepe. You're not what we think of as the term hunter and gatherer is just such a primitive term. These
right.
are not hunters. I mean, we hunt and gather today, but we're not. This is not a primitive culture.
They lived.
I think we often, when I say we, my academic colleagues often underestimate how much they knew, how much they understood about the cycles of the sun, of nature, that type of thing. I want to make two points here. One, they may have had some forewarning because they knew what to look for, what signs of agitation you would see in the sun. And I want to get back to the beginning of the Younger Dryas, which is 1,200 years earlier. My work, as I'm putting the evidence together, indicates that the Younger Dryas actually was set off, that cold period, ironically, was set off by a solar event also, by a solar outburst also.
Or a dropping of solar intensity.
Or maybe followed by a dropping of solar intensity. But one hypothesis I have, which the evidence seems to fit, is that it was not a comet. A lot of people have talked about a comet and that a comet would spread dust in the atmosphere to cause a cooling event. But if you had a solar outburst at 10,900 BC, when you look at the geologic environment at that time, there were huge lakes on the top of glaciers. This has been known for over 100 years, and huge lakes on tops of glaciers, especially in North America, with a solar outburst, you would melt the ice dams that were holding back those lakes. You would have all this runoff into the North Atlantic. It would change the currents in the Atlantic, and it would cause a cooling event temporarily and a destabilization. And a deep freeze, which is exactly what you see with the Younger Dryas. So actually, the evidence, ironically, indicates to me, and there's a lot of other scientists who are now looking at these same types of things, that it might have been a solar event that set off the cooling period at 10,900 BC, and then another even larger solar event, solar outburst, that snapped us out of the last ice age at 9700 BC. Taking that into account, these people, we'll call it the civilization of that time, they had experienced a major event not that long ago. And something that I found in my study of ancient civilizations is that most ancient civilizations, and I feel very confident saying this as a generalization, they had a much better sense of time, deep time, cycles of nature, cycles of cosmos. You see that from everywhere, from the Egyptians recording time over vast periods, over many, many, many millennia, the Maya recording time over numerous millennia, the traditions of different ages, as Katie already mentioned, Plato talks about this. So our civilization seems to be very short term. We think only in terms of
right.
a few years.
We're very compressed. Our consciousness of time is very compressed. I think because perhaps our lives are so filled with busyness in a way.
Yes.
Now, Free Dreamlander, speaking of busyness, get busy and do what these commercials suggest you should.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh-Pasulka says, enter this risky new world and leave empowered. New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, riveting, I couldn't put it down. Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
We're talking to Dr. Robert and Katie Schock. Their website is robertschock.com. They have a new documentary that they are working on. It is you can donate for it at Oracle, the Oracle website, and you can click through to the Oracle website from the Dreamland show page. Robert is also the author of many books, and there isn't one that isn't extraordinary. Right now, most of what we're talking about relates to a book called Forgotten Civilization, which I'm sure you can find in bookstores. You can certainly find it on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. We're also referring, and we'll refer a little more, to the book he wrote with Robert Bavall, Origins of the Sphinx, Celestial Guardian of the Pre-Pharaonic Civilization, because I want to get into that civilization and what it was like, because here what we're just talking about, let me just build a little picture for you folks here. We are talking about these enormous cave systems carved, built, underground cities capable of housing tens of thousands of people and built over, God, how long, Robert and Katie, do you have any estimate of how long it took to build those?
No, I really don't. I have not tried to do any calculations along those lines. Although I think when you have a lot of incentive to do something like that, you tend to do it. You know, I think they really brought together their resources and human power
yes.
to do it as they needed to do it. I only think of just a quick example. I know it's very different, but recently, with a virus outbreak, look at China building new hospitals in 10 days. You know, when
yes.
you have a real incentive, you do it quickly.
You do it quickly.
But you also do it in preparation, because as we were talking about, I think they knew that these things might be coming.
But the one
The first solar outburst might have been what triggered this. In other words, they might have actually seen animals and people dying on the ground because of it, and there would have been extraordinary auroras and so forth. It would have been a very noticeable event.
Absolutely, absolutely, and we now are documenting records that they saw those auroras, that they were aware of this. Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, one of the aspects, and this ties in with the work of a Los Alamos plasma scientist. Plasma is a reference to electrically charged particles that are given off, for instance, by the sun during a major solar outburst. They impact the atmosphere, the magnetosphere. They cause what we can refer to as plasma configurations in the sky. That's a fancy way of saying things like the aurora borealis, but much more specific, much more diagnostic. Some of them look like dancing figures in the sky, sort of like stick men with birds' heads. And Dr. Anthony Peratt of Los Alamos National Laboratory, back in the late 80s, early 1990s, first noticed that many very ancient petroglyphs, ones that, and this is my dating, go back to the end of the last ice age, were recording exactly what you would see in the sky during a major solar outburst. So this became a, we've now been studying this, he's been studying this, other people have been studying it, and we see these motifs in antiquity that relate directly to what you see during a solar outburst.
Yeah, this is a research that's been going on with Dr. Perot for, I think, about 2 decades now, and he has found examples. He supports his thesis with examples from all over the world that some of the most ancient petroglyphs in over 130 countries all have these unique diagnostic shapes, and he details what they are: stick figure men with birds' heads and cascading cylindrical shapes. I mean, you'd have to read the book to get into it, but really, it's just all over. And so what he says is that this is an indication that people saw these shapes in the sky and recorded on rock what they were seeing. Another line of evidence of massive solar activity in antiquity, along with isotope data and all the other real empirical data.
Yeah, he tells a funny story. We've seen it in a video of one of his presentations, and I've met him in person, but I think of this anecdotal comment he made. Apparently, when he saw some of the petroglyphs at first, he had the thought, like, where did they see this? Or whoever drew this, where did they see this? Because this is classified data that he had been working on in Los Alamos, and there it is, drawn on a petroglyph.
Yeah, high-tech, expensive plasma physics that they're only starting to discover now is all over ancient rocks.
I'll mention the Ronga Ronga.
Yeah, we actually expanded upon Dr. Perot's work, and I'm pleased to have been able to contribute to Robert's research, because we were shortly after a trip to Easter Island back in 2010, I think it was.
Yeah.
Was it 2010?
2010.
We actually connected Easter Island's previously undeciphered script called Rongo Rongo to Dr. Perot's work. It's actually where Dr. Perot's petroglyphs one could think of as photographs or isolated words. The Rongo Rongo is a scientific text of some of the solar activity, I think, that was being witnessed here on Earth. And actually, we did receive confirmation from a member of his team about that.
So. Yeah, that they had actually independently discovered that, but had not published it.
Yeah. So there's now mounting evidence, which is why we actually have to do this documentary.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's not just the Sphinx. The Sphinx was the first huge piece of the puzzle, and it really did ignite a firestorm.
I'd like to mention one other piece of evidence to give credit where credit is due, and that is the late Cornell University astronomer Thomas Gold. He studied some of the early lunar data that was collected by the Apollo missions, and he came to the conclusion that the moon had been hit by a huge solar event. Again, at the end of the last ice age is my dating of it based on the evidence. And if the moon was hit by a huge solar event, the Earth was hit simultaneously, because the moon and the Earth are essentially one little system compared to the sun. People didn't want to believe it. They didn't deny it, but they sort of brushed it under the rug because it's too scary to even think about.
It's Barbara Hand-Klaus Catastrophobia, and that's the name of the book, by the way. Catastrophobia.
Oh, that's it. But exactly, people don't want to think about this. They want their stable, safe world. And the world, unfortunately, is not so stable and safe in a cosmic perspective, in the perspective of celestial mechanics, more or less how the sun and the planets interact with each other.
Yeah, it was actually the Rongo Rongo discovery connecting to Dr. Perot's work, and also returning from Turkey and seeing not just Göbekli Tepe dated to the end of the last ice age, but also the underground cities, and all, it put all the pieces really the seemingly disparate pieces of the ancient world. It just all came together with the sun, and that really was what inspired Robert to write Forgotten Civilization. So there's a whole lot in there, but we're now putting it in a visual medium.
And development since then, because there's been so many more discoveries
since, but but you can only get so much. So,
well, I would like to talk when we come back about what was here before, because there was a before, and we have a wealth of evidence, actually, of what that world was like. And I think the two of you probably know how to describe it, but we're going to go probably to that in the third half hour. What I want to talk about now is this, is when we get to do another break. When we get back, about our sun. Our sun is this type of star called a yellow dwarf. And we're going to talk about that. And we're going to also talk about what might have triggered this eruption on the sun in the past and where we are with that. Now, because on Dreamland, we ain't got catastrophobia. We can look at these things straight in the eye. We're not afraid. We'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff, Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's getting great reviews. Take a look on Amazon. It's available as a Kindle, as an ebook everywhere else, and as a paperback at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and as also as a hardcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and as an audiobook read by me on Audible.com. We're talking to Robert and Katie Schock. Their website, robertschock.com. And when you go to robertschock.com, you can look at all of the work they're doing. You can go on tours with the Schocks, which must be brain bending. I have to tell you, I cannot imagine a more exciting way to see this world it would be with the Schocks. Can you tell us about your upcoming tours?
Oh, yeah. I would love people to join us. We've been talking a little bit about Turkey and Cappadocia and Göbekli Tepe. I would love people to join us. We have a tour planned for June this year, June 2020, for Turkey. We've done this a number of times in the past, taking people to Turkey to see all the major ancient sites. We have a wonderful time. It's one of our favorite tours, I think, mm-hmm. for Katie and I to do together and have people join us. So we're really excited about that. We have another tour to Armenia and Lebanon in August, which is also a very exciting tour, and we're looking forward to that. And if people go to our website, robertshock.com, they can go to the tour page, and we actually have more tours planned for the future going
the next 2 years.
Yeah, the next 2 years or so. But right now we're gearing up for the June tour to Turkey to see many of the sites we're talking about right now. Everything in the trailer we will take people to see.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be so exciting. I wish I could do it, but I have a summer that's loaded with appearances, and which is good because I'm getting invited to lots of things. But I would love to go with you. I have to tell you, I just think it would be a marvelous experience.
We'd love to have you sometime.
We have to do it sometime, absolutely. Now let's discuss this little star that we follow, we call the sun. It is a yellow dwarf, and it is moving through a galaxy, circling, orbiting a galactic center. Now, yellow dwarfs that we observe, other yellow dwarfs, and they're very common. It's a common form of star. They're generally quite stable. But they have a tendency to blow off steam big time every once in a while. And there is a book called Hamlet's Mill, which you guys, I'm sure, are very familiar with.
Oh, sure.
By Giorgio di Santayana and Hertha von Detchen, which I have read carefully, and my wife Anne read it two or three times. And it appears, it makes a very convincing case that the past left a warning for us in stone about the sun being a very friendly sun from time to time, but then, like Hamlet in the play, occasionally going mad. Can you tell us about what those occasional events might be like?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a very good way to put it. Hamlet's Mill is a great book. I recommend it. It's a dense book, but I recommend it to people. But what I'm finding, based on the physical evidence, and when I say physical evidence, geological evidence, archaeological evidence, isotope data, and sediment cores, ice cores, is that the sun undergoes a periodicity of time when it goes mad, to use an anthropomorphic term. Another way of saying it is that it goes into disequilibrium, and it has to recalibrate. It has to equilibrate. So it seems to go into these shorter periods of disequilibrium when, as you think, I think you used the term, blows off steam and then recalibrates itself. And what we're finding, and this is very tentative and rough right now, is that crudely it's about, I would say, a 12,000-year cycle. And it is, unfortunately for us in this day and age, about 12,000 years since the last major eruption of the sun at the end of the last ice age. Now, it goes through variations in between, and it has more minor eruptions, that type of thing. But it does go through periods where it's very, very, very active, and then very quickly it seems like it goes into a period of inactivity, then it gets very active again. So it actually varies between extremes over a very short period of time. And I want to stress that because some people say right now that the sun seems to be going dormant. It's becoming inactive. Well, that is when, based on the past evidence, you have to be worried about the sun the most, because when it seems like it's becoming very inactive, that's when it will explode and get very active again.
Yeah, the
which is why NASA sent that probe there,
Exactly. We believe that's the case. And Katie was just beginning to bring up the Carrington event again in 1859. That actually happened during what seemed like a lull.
A little bit of a low cycle, minor lull
in the sun, but that's when it exploded with the Carrington event. What we see at the end of the last ice age is that it was going through extremes of activity, inactivity, activity, inactivity, and that's when you get these major solar outbursts. And we're going into that again. There was a paper published in Nature and Nature is one of the most prestigious journals in the world by a group of astrophysicists that pointed out the sun is more active now than it has been in, I think they phrased it, the last 11,000 years, but basically since the end of the last ice age. So,
in other words, civilization reemerged 3,000 or so BC during this somewhat quiescent period for the sun, but that is now, unfortunately, worrisomely, it's changing. Now we are going into this erratic period again.
Right. And also something else I want to mention is that more and more work is now coming out, and literally within the last few years, that solar-type stars, more or less stars like our sun, are less stable than people realized they were, than astronomers realized they were, that they're actually... The sun is not unusual, as you were saying, at all, and it's not unusual for its class of stars. Now that we have a little over a century of really accurate astronomical data in certain realms, because we're a very young civilization when it comes to technological sophistication. So when you're talking about records of stars and how they change over time, most stars, we have almost no data on that in real time. And we're finding, astronomers, astrophysicists are finding that solar-type stars are actually less stable than was generally assumed even 10, 20 years ago.
Now, one of the things that I have noticed is that there seems to be a rise in the number of asteroids and objects we're seeing flying past. In the meteor websites are very careful because they'd rather be wrong than alarm people. So I'm not sure, but could it be that the sun periodically enters a dirty area, as it were, of space? And, well, for example, a comet, NASA took a video a few years ago that shows a comet impacting the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the sun is gigantic, and a comet by comparison is tiny, the speck of dust, but the reaction in the star is very dramatic.
Yeah. Oh, we've seen that. Katie, you want to comment?
No, I was just saying, We keep an eye on the sun in what ways we can, and you do see that if a comet flies into it, it will sometimes respond by shooting off a CME or destabilize a plasma filament, or you'll see a reaction. So
I was going to say, a crude analogy that just came to my head is like sticking a little pin into a balloon and it bursts. but my point right now is that I personally am convinced that the sun is in a portion of its cycle where it is much less stable than it is when it's in other portions of its cycle. When I say its cycle, it's, say, 12,000-plus-year cycle. So it may be that smaller factors like a comet or asteroid impacting the sun can destabilize it more because it's at that tipping point, if that makes sense, where things like that can destabilize it. So I wanted to summarize three different factors that I've been thinking about for the sun. One, I believe, based on the evidence, that it goes through periods of instability and stability. It has to recalibrate itself just from its internal dynamics, and that's probably a, crudely regular cycle. Secondly, and you mentioned this in the introduction, the sun is going around the galaxy, and it actually sort of goes like a wave through the galaxy, and it impacts or goes through areas that are less dense, more dense, various electromagnetic filaments on a galaxy size scale. That's going to affect the sun. The sun has a lot of magnetic and electrical properties, so as it goes through various fields, it goes through various dust clouds, that's going to impact it and affect it. And then when you get things like asteroids and comets and whatnot going into the sun or even flying close by, that can potentially destabilize it too. And in my opinion, if the sun is already at sort of a tipping point or going into a period of instability, so you've got unstable sun to begin with, it may not take much to cause a solar outburst.
Yes, but there also is still yet another, and this is speculation, but there could be another scenario at play, and there are some people who are looking into this. Robert doesn't really write about it other than to mention it, but if our sun does have a companion, if our sun is in a binary system, mm-hmm. is that the way to put it?
Yes.
It has a recurring, and some people link this to the precessional cycle, the precession of the equinoxes. If that is what is behind it, that we repeat our journey, it explains that we come upon similar circumstances in similar parts of space.
Cyclically.
So if it is that, for example, our sun crosses what they call the galactic galactic plane or the galactic equator, it could be something that perhaps emanates from there. But you know, there are a lot of factors, and some do say that perhaps our cycle, if we do travel with a companion star, could be one of the issues involved in.
Yeah, I'm glad Katie brought that up, because the whole concept of the sun being having a companion, more or less we're in a binary system, a lot of people would say that's crazy. You look up in the sky and you don't see another sun, you don't see two suns, but there could be a situation where that companion is either, quote, dark, it might be far enough away that we aren't directly aware of it. We have a colleague and friend named Walter Cruttenden, who has done a lot of work on the concept that the sun may have a companion, and makes a very compelling case that it's very likely, highly probable, that the sun has a companion, even though we haven't been able to identify that companion yet. And he does believe that this is the reason for the precessional cycles, and it's not simply a wobble in Earth's orbit, but it's more complex than that. And if there is this hypothetical companion, that could help destabilize the sun on a cyclical basis. For instance, if the companion sun and our sun come closer together at some times versus further apart, or if they're in orbit, one would not orbit the other. They'd actually be orbiting around the center of their mass, collective mass, but it could cause various factors too. The bottom line, in my opinion, and studying this for a couple of decades now, is that we actually don't know as much about the sun and what drives the sun and what the internal dynamics are and the external effects on the sun are. We're still at a very primitive stage when it comes right down to it.
We have interviewed Walter Cruttenden on Dreamland a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And subscribers, you can listen to these interviews. There's a great one from 2011 called "Is There Something Out There?" So we're familiar with Walter's work here on Dreamland and respect it very much. He makes a terribly convincing case that there is a dark companion out there somewhere, distantly, and it's too distant from us. We haven't found it yet, but it seems it's there. And if that's the case, then it is affecting, its movements are affecting our star. We are coming to the end of our first hour, and we're in the second, in the final 30 minutes, we're going to talk about what was here before. What did we lose? What left us in a state of amnesia about our own past, unable emotionally to look at what is there plain to see? Free Dreamlanders, as always, thank you for listening, and come over to unknowncountry.com and join the adventure by subscribing. You cannot spend your money in this area of interest any more wisely than, in my opinion, than joining this wonderful website.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.